Okay, this is the Book of Mormon Quandary panel. There will be only three panelists besides myself. I'm the moderator. I'm Leonard Wald. There will be three panelists besides me. Jeff Needle was unable to come. He is ill and will not be able to come. He's a diabetic and he had a serious attack just recently. It seemed to me to be dangerous for him to come up this far. So I will give a little bit, a very short version of what Jeff would say, but the other three people are right here. Now I'd like each of them to introduce themselves with a short version of who they are and where they come from. And I will introduce myself. You have to think of me as a scientist, primarily, rather than someone who is deeply immersed in religion. So things I say, you should keep that in mind. I was educated in the University of Utah with chemical engineering. Then I went to the University of Michigan, and I finally got a PhD in nuclear engineering and nuclear physics. So I have a certain prejudice in that direction. Now, I will start by giving a short summary of the quandary. And then we'll have each of the panelists give a short statement on each one of those things. I'd like to save a significant amount of time for questions, because we suspect that there will be quite a few questions from the floor. So I'll start here. Over the past two decades, a large body of serious scientific evidence has accumulated that throws a dark cloud over the LDS Church explanation of the origin of the Book of Mormon. This evidence can be classified under four categories. First, historical, and there I refer to Grant Palmer's book, An Insider's View of Mormon Origins. Second, genetic. I refer to Seven Daughters of Eve, but that's not even necessarily the best of the particular references on it, but it's easily accessible and it's easy to read. Third is linguistic. I refer to a Scientific American article there called World Linguistic Diversity, where they describe where world languages really came from. It turns out that the languages that exist in the New World, do not come from, do not come from the Middle East. They have a different origin. The fourth is archaeological, and there I refer to a science article called Monteverde and the Pleistocene Peopling of Americas. It turns out that the current archaeological evidence does not support Middle East origin for the Book of Mormon people, you might say. The above references are just a sampling of many first-class references on these subjects. The purpose of this panel discussion is not to discuss the merit of this evidence that stands very well on its own feet, but to discuss two very important questions that result from this evidence. First, how should we as church members feel about and respond to this evidence and the shadow it casts on the Book of Mormon origins? Second, how should I as an individual feel about and respond to this evidence and problems it creates in my own personal philosophy and religious practice? That's what I've asked these gentlemen to deal with. But as an introduction, I would like to give a very quick statement about each of these issues. As a church member, this evidence appears to be initiating a crisis for the LDS Church, although this does not appear to be generally recognized on the upper levels of the church authorities. Word is racing rapidly through the ranks of the church membership and the media interested in the church. The paradigm under which the church operates may have to be changed in response to this crisis. Let me define these words in order to make my meaning clear. What is a paradigm? A paradigm is a philosophical structure and a set of operational rules for the church, which has been successful enough to attract an enduring group of adherents from other beliefs and also is sufficiently open to provide productive work for these adherents to pursue so they can maintain interest. Note that a paradigm is not necessarily the church's doctrine or fundamental beliefs or the gospel. A change of paradigm does not necessarily require rejection of the church's fundamental doctrine. A crisis is an event caused by the discovery of an anomaly. And I talked about four of those anomalies. That has somehow violated the paradigm. Paradigm-induced expectations we find in normal church operations. It concludes that the paradigm is changed enough so that the anomalies has become, it concludes when the paradigm is changed enough so that the anomalous has become the expected. These definitions are adapted from a very common and a very important reference on that particular item. Now, as an individual, this evidence is initiating a crisis in many people's own personal religious beliefs. The religious paradigm in which these people operate may have to be changed in response to this crisis. Again, the paradigm is not necessarily your fundamental beliefs. A change in paradigm does not necessarily require rejection of the church doctrine. Now, I'm going to stop at this point, pass it on to the group. We'll go down through the group in the sequence. It's listed here. We'll start with Trent Stevens.
Hi, Leonard asked me to tell you a little bit about myself before beginning, and maybe I'll keep this rolling off. I grew up in a suburb of Malta, Idaho. Malta has a population of 200, and I grew up in a suburb about 10 miles outside of there, so metropolitan, the center of the universe. I attended Brigham Young University for about 6 years, graduated from there three times. I just tell people that first you didn't take. I have a bachelor's degree in microbiology from BYU, a bachelor's degree in zoology, and a master's degree in zoology from BYU. My major thrust while I was at BYU was in genetics, including human genetics, population genetics. I was essentially interested in molecular biology. Like Leonard, I am a scientist. I'm not a theologian particularly or a historian, although both of those fascinate me, and I've written books about the interface of science and religion and the history of science and those sorts of things. I spent much of my time at BYU as a Farkel. If anyone is familiar with the zoology department there, I was in Farkel's Fantastic Fly Factory, run by Dwayne Jeffrey, while I was at BYU. After graduating from there, I went to the University of Pennsylvania. My interest that led me there was because of a particular person, Jay Lash, who was doing work on the mechanism of action of thalidomide and general vertebrate development. My interest in going to him was to understand vertebrate shape from a developmental perspective, a discipline called morphogenesis, and that's been my discipline for the last 30 years. So that's my mainstream area of research interest. I teach anatomy, including gross anatomy, head and neck anatomy, neurobiology, neuroanatomy, and developmental biology at Idaho State University. Before I went to ISU, I did a postdoc at the University of Washington in pediatrics for 4 years. Served a mission in the Great Lakes Mission, Michigan and Indiana. Aside from my mainstream interests, I pretty much try to stay to myself and mind my own business. And as T.H. Morgan said, stay out of the halls because they lead to committee rooms. And so I try to stay in my lab and do my own thing and let other people do their own thing. But I found myself got myself into trouble a few times by sort of stepping out of my office, if you will. About 10 years ago, I had an a student come to me who was a non-traditional student, a theater major, who was taking general zoology in our department, and a student who was teaching the course was getting into the idea of, because evolution is correct, then all religion is sort of out the window. And so this student complained to our department chairman about the way the course was being taught, and the department chairman sent him to me. So I then proceeded to spend 2 hours talking to him about science and religion from an LDS perspective, he being LDS as well. And after 2 hours was over, he said, "Well, this is great. It's been very helpful. What book can I read that can help me with this?" And I said, "Well, there isn't any." And so he said, "Well, why don't you write one?" And I said, "Well, my plan is to do that someday. It's on the back burner." And he said, "No, I mean, why don't you write one now?" And so with his help, Jeff Meldrum, who is in our department, and I wrote the book Evolution and Mormonism, A Quest for Understanding, with Forrest Peterson helping us on that, which we specifically wrote to sort of help students who are in the same quandary about science and religion. Well, again, minding my own business, I think Tom, in fact, got us involved in presenting our book at Sunstone. We published it with the Signature Books. And 2 years consecutively, we were at Sunstone talking about that book. And the second year we were there, Brent Metcalf called me about 2 weeks before the Sunstone Symposium and said, "We're doing a panel discussion on the Mormon and Native Americans, and we can't find anybody that will speak to the other side of the issue." Brent Metcalf and Tom Murphy were there to talk about the problems that these people were creating for the church, and Brent was having anyone to talk about the other side of it. So I said, "Well, you know, that's not my area of expertise. I was in genetics many, many years ago, but not much now." And I said, "I have read the literature on this." And so I ended up being there and brought Jeff Meldrum with me, and so we were sort of the panel discussion members, and since then I've sort of become the classic definition of an expert, an unknown drip under pressure, right, Tom? So with that introduction, let me just give you some perspectives from my point of view here. First of all, I totally agree with what Leonard has said about the data. The data are numerous, internally consistent from paper to paper, from study to study, consistent with the archaeological data, consistent with much of the linguistic data, consistent with much of the anthropological perspective that's been around for 400 years. And so there really isn't much to say about the data. What I can say about that is that the current data indicate that 99.6% of the genetic markers that have been looked at, both from mitochondrial DNA and from Y chromosome analyses, show genetic markers that are consistent between Native Americans, the extant Native Americans, and extant Asian populations, specifically, are largely Northern Asian Siberian populations. So those are the data. And I agree that we are now then, as a church, in the midst of a paradigm shift. Because I, as I assume most other people who grew up in the church, had a started out with at least a hemispheric perspective of the Book of Mormon. The concept of a more limited geography started coming out after I was out of high school and started changing that paradigm somewhat, but still largely the concept that Native Americans were in a substantial way, or at least those in Central and South America, descended from Lehi's colony and Muloch's colony in the Americas. I think that paradigm is shifted considerably, or is shifting. I want to emphasize two other things in this regard, and that is the stated purpose of the Book of Mormon. The purpose of the Book of Mormon, as stated, is not to give a history of the Americas or a history of the Native Americans or even a history of the descendants of Lehi. In fact, statement is made a number of times in the Book of Mormon that history of the kings, the military history, the secular history is given in another record, which we're not privy to. The purpose of the record that we have is a religious purpose, and its stated purpose is as a second witness of Jesus Christ. Now, I recognize that there are a lot of people who question the authenticity of Jesus Christ as a real person, that his life actually happened, or if it did happen, question the divinity. And so the stated purpose of the Book of Mormon is important in that regard as a second witness. So that brings up the whole question of the historicity of the Book of Mormon, and probably is the center of the debate between myself and others who also agree with the data but have a different take on the interpretation of those data. And that's what I'm going to talk about in just a moment. The third issue, and I think this has come up, at least in my mind, from discussions that Jeff Melder, my colleague at ISU, and I have had about this paradigm shift since the time we were on this previous panel, that the whole concept of Israel in the world is it's always described, Israel is described as being the salt or the leaven, not the bread. And in fact, if we look at the Book of Mormon history as a history of a complete people or a hemispheric history, then we're looking at the bread, we're not looking at the leaven. And the concept, the notion that Israel is to be scattered throughout the world, to be a blend of the world, in relation to the Abrahamic covenant, would be a different scenario if all of the descendants, all of the Native Americans were descended from the Lehite colony. So, with that said, are we... Is the intent to go through our whole the whole discussion,
yeah,
each one of us, and then come?
Yeah, each one at a time.
Okay.
We'll come back. I'll
okay.
do a little summing up, knowing you
right.
had a lot of questions.
So let me first of all state that part of what I'm going to say, or much of what I'm going to say, has been published in the last two or three months in two papers. One that Jeff Oldham and I co-authored, which is in the Journal of Book of Mormon Studies. That came out about 2 months ago, I think. And then the second one is a paper that I wrote myself that came out just in this most recent Sunstone. So first of all, if we take the premise that Lehi made a statement, a prophetic statement about his descendants, and I want to sort of focus on that, on the context of that particular event, both from the question of what do we know about it from science, and what are the limitations of science in relation to that sort of a statement, and secondly, what are the limitations of religion in relation to that sort of a statement. So I want to take that on first, and that is to say Lehi stood somewhere in the world, or somewhere in Joseph Smith's mind, and made the following statement, that this land is going to be protected from other people, and no one will come to this land unless God brings them here. I'm going to keep that very, very concise to that sort of a concept. So I want to look at two things: the question of what's the evidence that Lehi ever said that, and or that there was a Lehi, and secondly, what does this land mean to Lehi and to us? If Lehi was standing somewhere in Mesoamerica or somewhere on the Malay Peninsula, it doesn't really matter where he was standing at the time that he made this statement. And this is now advancing a hypothesis that Lehi was standing somewhere and made this statement. He may have been sitting, I don't know. If we had a bloodhound in roughly 730 B.C. or so, excuse me, 570 B.C. or so, within a matter of a few hours to a couple of days after Lehi was there, we could actually have demonstrated Lehi's presence if this bloodhound was attuned to his scent. Or if we happened to be there at the time, we would actually be an eyewitness to this event. So we would actually have data that we could rely upon. Likewise, if Lehi had touched something while he was there, we would have fingerprints that would be there again for a matter of hours or days. But I think it's clear to all of us that it doesn't take long for the scent associated with a person or animal or anything else to disappear or dissipate to the point where there are no longer any molecules left that can be that are odorants that can be picked up. Likewise, the oils that are responsible for moisture, that are responsible for fingerprints, eventually will disappear, and there are no molecules left at that site that had anything to do with this person. So those sorts of physical evidence disappear very quickly. Now, does that mean that the person was never there? I think that's an absurd idea to say that because we don't have that scientific evidence, that person was never there. If we look at longer-lasting evidence, let's say that Lehi gave this speech in a building. There's a discussion that soon after Lehi's family arrived in the Promised Land, that they built a temple. Or certainly, as soon as Nephi's group separated the Lamanites, they built a temple. And so they may have had some sort of a religious edifice already, and maybe he was standing in a church making this sort of a statement. Is there any physical evidence of a church being there? Well, we know from archaeological data compared to historic data that a house can clearly exist in a place, someplace on the earth, and 100 years later, or 200 years later, absolutely no indication whatsoever of an edifice ever being there. The stones can all be removed. If it had a stone foundation, the stones can all be removed, the land can be plowed up. No sign whatsoever of a building ever existing. It happens over and over and over again in archaeology. Now, what about genetic information? If Lehi was standing on a site and made such a prophecy and never had any children and then died, the bones were not preserved over any length of time, and again, from archaeological information, we know that it takes certain types of soil conditions, atmospheric conditions, to preserve human remains over a long period. It can completely deteriorate. And so, again, no evidence may have existed whatsoever. But we're here to talk about the idea that in the case where he did have children, and those children had children, and we have then the history of this group of people. Now, what happens then to that genetic information? How likely are we that this genetic information is still present and that can be identified? Clearly, if it's the entire population, that genetic information would be accessible, and we could then, by analysis of what are called haplotypes, genetic markers, we could identify the origin of this people. And that's what this whole discussion is about. That analysis has been made, and it has been found that we cannot find any descendants of this person, Lehi, if the claim is that they came from the Middle East. The problem with the loss of data is not as clear-cut as the case with the loss of fingerprints, or the loss with odorants, or the loss of rocks from the foundation of a building. Most people don't understand genetics to the extent that they understand these other physical pieces of information. And that's part of the problem with some of the debate that's been going on about the data. One of the things we have to look at in population genetics, one of the things that's a major issue in population genetics, is a concept called bottlenecks. Now, we recognize two major bottlenecks that occurred in relation to this population. One of them is a historic bottleneck, if we believe the Book of Mormon chronology and historicity, and that is that in 421 A.D., the Nephites were annihilated by the Lamanites. And then what's interesting about that statement is that even after they annihilated the Nephites, they were warring amongst themselves. We have no idea whatsoever how many people survived that internal holocaust. The number of survivors may have been extremely small. But by any consideration, if this account is correct, then there was a major bottleneck that occurred. The second book was one that's more readily accessible to us historically, and that is the bottleneck that occurred in the 16th century. It's estimated that between 1500 A.D. and 1600 A.D., approximately 90 to 95% of the entire population of the Americas was annihilated by either disease or conquest or in between. This bottleneck affected some populations more than others. If we look, for example, at in Uruguay, the native population in Uruguay by 1820 was completely gone. So we have no genetic connection to that population left that are extant peoples. What happens with a bottleneck? What happens is that you have a large number of genes on one side of the bottleneck that don't make it through the bottleneck. That's the bottom line. And I just want to use this as an example of that to sort of bring it down to our own to thinking in sort of non-genetic concept of I'm wearing my tie specifically for a reason today, and this is a Buchanan tartan. I'm a Buchanan. I'm as much a Buchanan as I am a Stevens. It just happens that my paternal line is Stevens. My maternal grandmother was a Buchanan. Now, from that perspective, I know where my Y chromosome came from, if the records are correct. My Y chromosome can be traced back along the Stevens line for many, many generations. Now, at least 10 generations, we can trace the Stevens line back. And so I have that in common with the Stevens paternal line. On the other side of the spectrum, my mitochondrial DNA came from Julia Ann Buchanan. And so at least in one generation, it passed through a Buchanan, but that's it. Thereafter, it followed the maternal line, and before that, it was following the maternal line. So the mitochondrial DNA is going to change names every generation. And then everything else in between are called autosomes. And one of the things that's interesting about the genetic analysis of populations, the autosomes are essentially unusable because there's so much crossing over and so much mixing going on that they're really not usable for tracing ancestors. So really all you have is the paternal line and the maternal line. But if I ask the question, am I related to the Buchanans and how can I prove that, that's sort of where we are getting to in terms of the genetic data. I'm descended from Julia Ann Buchanan. One-fourth of my autosomes ought to be from her, roughly. So that would be approximately 11 of my 44 autosomes are coming from Julia Ann Buchanan. But only half of those in her are Buchanan. The other half came from her, from the Zufelt family that she descended from. And are, in fact, German and Austrian and Swiss. So only half of those 11 chromosomes are actually Buchanan, and really only half of those are Buchanan because even her father was only half Buchanan, and so on and so on. If we go back to that time, to Julia Ann Buchanan, my grandmother, one-fourth of my chromosomes or one-fourth of any of my genes, genetic markers can be traced there. If we keep going back any farther, if we go back 10 generations, for example, to George Buchanan, who was a covenanter in the end of the 17th century, he was a Presbyterian covenanter living in Scotland and fought against the English for religious freedom, was defeated at the Battle of Bothwell Bridge in 1682 and then fled Scotland and went to Ireland. And then his descendant was the one that came later on to America in 1800. So the question is then, am I descended from George Buchanan? If I look at my pedigree going back 250 years, my pedigree says I'm descended from George Buchanan. The probability of finding a genetic marker of that descent is 1 in 1,024. Of any genetic marker whatsoever. The probability of finding a Y chromosome linking me to George Buchanan or a mitochondrial DNA is zero. And so one of the questions that really needs to be asked is, if there is no physical genetic evidence of an individual or a group of people existing, does that eliminate their existence? And I just want to conclude that by saying that again, the importance of the record of the Book of Mormon is, number one, to talk about the Israelite distribution throughout the world as a leavening rather than the bread. The intent is not to be the bread of the world, not to be the foundation, but the leavening. And secondly, that its purpose is as a testimony of Jesus Christ. So at some point in that record, we have people who were physically in some location, and Jesus Christ, resurrected Jesus Christ, visited them. And then lastly, to put this in a perspective in terms of its relationship to the scientific data and our belief in Christ, I think it's important to look at Hebrews 11, which talks about the importance of faith in Christian function and as a very important force in our lives. And if we have proof that supports that faith, the faith no longer is faith, it becomes knowledge, according to the discussion of faith and knowledge in the Book of Alma. So I'll leave it at that.
The next one was supposed to be Jeff Needle. He can't be here, so let me just make a very quick statement as to what he might say. He is a Jew who converted to Christianity. He's been a member of several Christian churches. Some of them are somewhat exotic. He has been a member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, for example, and a couple of churches that I can't even remember the name of because they appeal to him in his particulars in Christianity. His position is the following. He says, recognize that the chances that the Book of Mormon are historical are relatively modest. Probably really modest, he would say. But he said, I don't think that the importance of the Book of Mormon is in that historicity. He said it is the fact of its existence, the fact that it was written by an illiterate boy, and the fact that it has a good deal of excellent theology in it, theology and religion in it, that is the important issue. Therefore, whether it is historical or not, for him, is not even an issue. He said it's an important book regardless and has meaning for your church and for me as an outsider. That would be his position. Now, let's go on next to Glenn.
Say what, why don't I play musical chairs with the fine bishop?
Sure, I'd be glad to have you here. Sit here if you like.
Well, maybe some of your smarts will rub off on me if you sit here. Go ahead and why don't you transfer the material to him as well. Thank you. Okay, I'll try to give a brief background. I'm not sure how to hold this mic, so I'll just guess. No, for heaven's sakes. But thank you. I'll be fine. All right. I guess I'm a long line of Protestant ministers in Appalachian, sort of hard-scrabbling coal mining Kentucky. My grandfather got out of there. His sons populated a couple other states. Of those three sons, one was my father, who was the actor, and I have very little dramatic talent, unfortunately, though I've picked up my father's penchant for music. His other two brothers, one is a retired professor of philosophy, the other is a retired president of a wire company, a Belden, a fairly large company, and I've, through the years, realized I'm some sort of perverse mixture of those two uncles, that I have a strong interest in philosophy and religion. My uncle, who was a retired philosophy professor, was a minister prior to getting his PhD in philosophy. And on the other hand, I've got an uncle who's fairly pragmatic and a successful businessman from whom I could learn much still, I'm sure. So I've somehow managed to have most of my family's bad habits come back to haunt me, and hopefully some good ones as well. I studied to be an orchestral musician until I realized I was a much better scientist than a musician, which, you know, wasn't saying much, frankly, and ended up being a pre-med in chemistry at BYU. I then went to Michigan. I did my MD at Michigan, a little of that, a PhD in neuroscience at UCLA, which was much I explained to people the PhD is the best vacation I ever had. I didn't have the uncertainty of whether I'd make it into med school, nor the certainty that I had too much work to do, which is what you have in med school. And I got to put together an amusing project and had much fun with it. I finished all that education. I'll do a brief artificial intelligence postdoc at a joint Harvard-MIT lab. I was there long enough to get it on my resume, but long enough to be smart, that sort of thing. Enjoyed that, and I've since had sort of a strong suit in biological science and a minor suit in information technology, artificial intelligence, complexity science. I finished the schooling. I went to a company called McKinsey. It's a management consulting firm that's famous for burning out Harvard and Stanford MBAs after a couple or 3 years. I stayed there for 3 years and moved on to Eli Lilly, makers of Prozac and other fine psychotropics. Was there for about 3 years doing various positions in strategy, marketing, and so forth. I then started my own company about 4 years ago where I help usually small companies formulate strategy and cut deals, mainly in biotechnology. I live up in Palo Alto with my wife and four very charming children. I have enjoyed my time in the church. It's had its struggles and its ambiguities and its uncertainties, but those hopefully have been for the better. When I was 6 years old, I was actually the only member of my family going to church. I was going to a Protestant church with a couple friends. So I was the youngest of three children, the only kid going to church in my family. I've just always cared about religion and philosophy, and that's a nasty habit I've inherited from my Appalachian ancestors, I'm afraid. And it's a good nasty habit, I would hope. So I'm not born in the church, but I've been in the church since I was 6 years old. So again, I don't fit any neat categories, and I generally don't fit in, which is the story of my life, but it hasn't all been miserable. So going on, let's move forward with my prepared remarks. I do apologize for finishing them off here. I have this exciting job that doesn't allow me to do a lot of things I love, such as write papers for Sunstone, so I managed to squeeze it in with a couple minutes to spare. Here's my ball. Is this fresh? You'll indulge me. I'll start with a passage from the fourth volume of the History of the Church. This is the collection of volumes in which a young Mormon is most likely to learn the term Apostolic Interregnum. So you probably remember these eight volumes sitting on a shelf somewhere. In a meeting with the 12 apostles, the prophet Joseph Smith told the brethren that the Book of Mormon was the most correct of any book on earth and the keystone of our religion, and a man would get nearer to God by abiding by its precepts than by any other book. And juxtaposed this canonical cornerstone with a number of scientific perspectives, including now the recent DNA samples taken from the indigenous populations of the Americas. In the words of Tyler, one might begin to feel like a Christian scientist with appendicitis. I will not dwell at length in analyzing the scientific rigor of Tom Murphy's work on DNA markers. In general, my experience has been that efforts to substantiate the historicity of the Book of Mormon with physical evidence have not been overwhelmingly encouraging in the affirmative. On the other hand, it does not appear that the number and distribution of DNA samples analyzed allow for an unequivocal ruling out of the prior existence on this continent of an Abrahamic people who were largely destroyed roughly 1.5 millennia ago. Of course, a number of other issues do arise. I'll give only one example here. You have other favorites, I'm sure. One would expect from currently accepted anthropological findings that the landmass in the Americas that is supportive of human civilization, per agriculture, hunting, dwelling, sort of thing, this landmass would largely have been populated long before the purported landing of the Jaredites, even 4 millennia ago. It's therefore curious that there is no mention in the Book of Mormon, at least to my recollection, and I've read it a few times, of the existence of people not descended from the migrations of the Jaredites, Mulekites, and Lehi's group. So personally, where do I come out in all this? I remain an active member of the LDS Church. I believe that my spiritual experience, testimony, and generally positive experience in the LDS community notwithstanding, the preponderance of this does not support the historicity of the Book of Mormon. I am preponderantly but not entirely persuaded against historicity. I no longer base my participation in the church on a literal belief in the historicity of the Book of Mormon. I have, if anything, been too quick, if not grateful, to accept the analyses and findings against historicity because I am more comfortable with the Book of Mormon as a work rich in metaphor and ideas than I am with it as a tome literally factual in all points. I held these views long before the publication of Dr. Murphy's work. Perhaps a majority of active LDS people would posit that the church stands or falls on the basis of the historical and doctrinal truth of the Book of Mormon. In contrast, I am not comfortable with discounting the church wholesale, even though I now look at the Book of Mormon as most probably being a 19th century narrative fabrication and doctrinal synthesis. At very least, I commend the good taste of Joseph Smith in incorporating beautiful, compelling passages from Matthew, 1 Corinthians, and especially Isaiah. One could argue that these passages once originated and now persist as crimes of wholesale plagiarism, but I am not disposed to sit in fretful judgment of Joseph Smith, whom I do take to be a prophet and a remarkable individual. He had his flaws, as is part of the design template the Creator applies to all of us. In fact, my general observation is that not most great men in history have also had great flaws. And if we were to discount Joseph Smith merely on the basis of his being a flawed, even a significantly flawed individual, then I suppose all of humanity would have nothing worth reading, as Christ, whom most Christians, including Mormons, believe to be the only flawless being, evidently left no manuscripts himself. I myself am an avid collector of antiquarian books, but have yet to hear of, let alone encounter, a signed first edition of the New Testament. I will now, for the next couple of minutes, pretend that I have a training in comparative literature. Since high school, when I actually read all four standard works in the course of seminary, the Bible in general and the New Testament in particular have persisted as the scriptures I have found most inspiring. To me, the overarching narrative, if you will, storyline of the Book of Mormon is that spoiled children produce rotten societies. The central phenomenon reported here is the cycle of repentance, redemption, growth, stratification, and decline of society, a process otherwise referred to as Nephi-Titus. This is arguably not the doctrinal center of the work, but is most plausibly its narrative center, starting with Lehi in Jerusalem removing his family from a society, to Mormon and Moroni serving as sad, reluctant leaders in a civilization breathing its last. The bright side seems to be that the mutual destruction depicted in the Book of Mormon leaves behind it a record from which others may benefit. Too bad about the protagonist populations upon whom the book is based. The repeated retreat of humanity in the Book of Mormon from balance, peace, and happiness perhaps smacks more of the oppressive, downward spiraling didacticism of postmodern novels than the positive message of the New Testament. In contrast, in the New Testament, starting with the Gospels and working through the Acts and the Epistles, notwithstanding the Book of Revelations, but take the arc all the way through the Epistles, the vast majority of the New Testament, I see an overarching narrative where a noble man, a perfect one in this exceptional case, makes a brave stand in a compromised society and founds a movement that is compelling in its philosophy, its immediate results, and its historical impact. That movement, Christianity, with all of its wrongs and ambiguities, persists unto this day and arguably continues to have a net positive effect on the well-being of mankind. To me, that is the narrative that is both inspired and inspiring. For that matter, the House of Judah, despite all of its complexities and disappointment in the Old Testament, also persists to this day and continues to make positive contributions to the well-being of mankind. For instance, by my last count, the House of Judah from the Old Testament has given us 141 Nobel laureates in the fields of science, economics, and literature. Arguably, the long-term narrative here is more inspiring than that given us by the House of Lehi, whose existence remains as of yet unsubstantiated by physical evidence. In truth, given the overwhelmingly depressing nature of its narrative arc, a sensitive human being, even a faithful member of the LDS Church, could quite justifiably hope that the Book of Mormon is not historically accurate. I am indeed comfortable with the Book of Mormon as a source of ideas and doctrine, where sincere efforts are made to characterize a God who is just and a calculus that justly balances justice with mercy and conviction with pragmatism. Even if the Book of Mormon is a 19th century fabrication, let us be fair. Because of the discovery that the Pentateuch, or the five books of Moses that begin the Old Testament, is not a robustly historical document. There are some who take even older scriptures, usually the Bible, in American society to be literally 100% correct. Some of these people base their reason for being, as well as the way they act in society and treat their fellow men, upon their own or a received strict translation of the Bible. These people are frequently referred to as fundamentalists. I have for years taken great exception to that term, as it implies a focus on fundamental principles, which in the case of Christianity, and certainly Mormonism as I understand it, would be a charitable love and humane human dignity. I would refer to the so-called fundamentalist movement instead as literalist, because of their reliance upon literal, harsh, legalistic, at times Procrustean interpretations of the Bible. In fact, given that we are dealing in this case with a fairly homogenous literal interpretation of the same text, I prefer to refer to this group as homotextuals. The evils of homotextuality are manifold. In general, the associate allows for an active choice of the homotextual lifestyle, but things and more prohibitively after one makes that choice. While critical thinking in this community is not uniformly forbidden, the constraints upon the pursuit of fair answers to certain meaningful questions is disallowed. In general, the homotextual community is more likely to condone the sacrifice of societal fairness and human dignity to received ideology. This can result in members of the Christian community taking unproductively harsh views towards certain sub-segments of society, such as the gay community. In the Islamic community, this thinking has resulted in the triumph of ideology over the World Trade Center, along with the lies of those who happened to be in there at the wrong time. So where do I go with all of this? I believe that I have bona fide spiritual experiences in the LDS Church, and I enjoy my participation in that community. I attend church regularly, and think it is a place for me and for my family. I tell people that in the practice of religion, I am more likely to do what I am told than believe what I am told. I feel that I am obligated to strive to be honest in heart. This means that if I am uncomfortable with something, I try to arrive at an answer based on principles rather than sources. I am brought to remember the charismatic 60s radical Abby Hoffman, whom I had the pleasure of meeting during graduate school, who said that becoming Republican was a good thing to do because it was easier than thinking. But personally, I tend to vote Republican, but probably not this time. I do not, however, allow preponderant comfort with one political party or the other at this point to serve as a substitute for critical thinking. Likewise, I do not allow even tight affiliation with my church to constitute an abdication from the responsibility to pursue robust intellectual constructs and to uphold human dignity. I will continue to participate as an active member of the LDS Church and hope that my wife and children will do so as well. I suppose that I will never conform completely to expected norms, but this is nothing new. I still play electrical and folk guitar music, but have never smoked marijuana. I graduated from medical school, but have not taken care of a patient since 1994. Likewise, I attend church regularly, but do not necessarily believe everything the person on the next pew does. Such diversity of opinion and approach should make the church more robust, not less. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Tom Kimball. I'm the marketing director for Signature Books. My background is I previously worked for Desert Book. I used to be the rare book buyer for Benchmark Books in Salt Lake. I'm currently the book review editor for the Journal of Mormon History. And I am Trent's publicist, as well as Grant Palmer's publicist, as well as Tom Murphy's publicist.
And he's one of my suppliers.
I thought I'd give you sort of a rundown. Well, first might I say that I don't feel that the issue of DNA in the Book of Mormon is to go gently into the night anytime soon. And may I also take the risk of saying that there are many heroes and villains in life and also in our church, and that I would like to say that I think that Trent is one of the great heroes in this drama. He's one of the men who is a faith-hearted saint, who's looking at this stuff seriously, and is willing to have a civil and respectful dialogue, and will be looked upon in years down the road as being one of the great men, and someone who I would like to turn my children to and say, hey, this is someone you should respect. I'd like to give you a little bit of a history of what's going on or how the issue of DNA in the church came about from my perspective. In the year 2000, there was a Sunstone Symposium session in Salt Lake City, as Trent had mentioned, that had Tom C., Brent Metcalf, Trent Stevens, and Jeff Meldrum. 2 years later, in May 2002,
Signature Books published a collection of essays called American Apocrypha. And in that selection of essays is a 30-page article by Tom Murphy dealing with anthropological look at DNA in the Book of Mormon. In that essay, he had three goals. His first goal was to point out that the American Indians are not necessarily the Lamanites. His second point was that we could not rule out a small migration to America from Israel with the studies that have been conducted so far. The third is that the genetic evidence that the current genetic studies and evidence would accelerate the idea that the Book of Mormon is a 19th century document. Of these three ideas, the first two have not been contested. They are pretty much universally agreed upon. The only thing that's been disagreed upon is the third, and that is, what does it mean in the end? In the winter of 2002, Tom Murphy's stake president invited Tom to have some conversations with him, which led to a church court in his behalf. At this point, Signature Books released a press release. Patty Hennis at the Associated Press picked that up, and the story ran internationally. It ran in Scotland. I saw articles in Australia. It ran in, articles ran in L.A. Times, New York Times, Chicago Times, Wall Street Journal, and then it even ran in the Salt Lake Tribune. It did not run in the Deseret News. Since then, since Tom Murphy's 30-page article, there has been several things. There's been a significant panel at BYU, which I attended, where they addressed the issues specifically that he raised. And also there has been 16 articles and reviews of Murphy and of the issue. And also on the church's website, there has been four essays, including Trent and Jeff Meldrum's, posted on the church's website. What's coming? Simon Sotherton, a geneticist from Australia, a plant geneticist, is currently publishing a book with Signature Books on the Book of Mormon DNA, and Trent Stevens and Jeff Meldrum are also working on a piece. Do you mind if I comment on that?
No, go ahead.
And my hope for that piece is that it will be something that could be presented to the freshman and sophomore college student to say, just as his Mormonism and Evolution book is, to say, here it is. Here's the issues. Here's the reality of it. Here's also how you can be a Latter-day Saint. Okay. As a book guy and as a guy who my whole world is wrapped around the book, and specifically Mormon books. I'm sort of a guru of 20th century Mormon books. The few observations that I do have, and that is that, first of all, American Apocrypha sold very modestly. It was only going to those people who were really interested. It wasn't going to missionaries. It wasn't going, it wasn't going out there broadly until Tom Murphy's stake president went after him and Signature did the press release. Then the book has sold well. But the lesson to be learned there really is that the best way to hide anything from Mormons is to publish it. It has been my experience as an active Latter-day Saint that as I, and specifically this year being the Book of Mormon year in our Sunday school lessons, that this issue is not really leaking out to the average Latter-day Saint. It may be being discussed within the highest echelons of the hierarchy. It's being discussed at BYU. It's being discussed at Sunstone. But beyond that, I don't see that it's really being discussed. In fact, I've only had one member of my ward approach me and say, Tom, come over here, and ask me, are you a copy publicist? Yeah. How'd you end up my ward? But to actually ask me a couple of intelligent questions, beyond that, I don't notice that anybody else in my ward has any clue that this is going on. And my thesis is that that is probably the case in all of the wards throughout the church. I don't think that this is an issue for the regular Latter-day Saint, as much as someone may want it to be. I don't think that this is an issue. I mean, another example for me that's not related would be the February 2003 article by Russell and Nelson on, you know, whether or not God loves us unconditionally and so forth. That one was a little bit softer of a subject, and I've gone around to all my neighbors and my friends and all that, and I've yet to meet someone not in Sunstone or not in my immediate core of friends at work that has ever even heard of that article, that it even existed. And it was in the Ensign. So rule number two, if you really want to hide it, publish it in the Ensign. anyway, I do see that there are some difficult issues. The issue of Zelf, I think, is something that's not being addressed. You know, Joseph Smith wrote an actual holograph in his own handwriting to his wife, which is essentially giving the revelation that, you know, here in the Midwest is this man, and he had a revelation that he was a great Nephite warrior. And I talked to another one of our authors, who is a descendant of Brigham Young, and she was able to actually hold the Zelf spearhead in her hand, and within the past 3 years, it's in the church archives. And Ken Godfrey up at the U of U has done the work on that subject. And to say that that's one of the problems that's going to have to be discussed with the limited geography issue is that we actually have Joseph Smith talking about the main Native Americans around him, and specifically Zelf in the Midwest and the northern United States, being the Lamanites. And the other thing that people have to the detractors of Murphy specifically are going to have to convince the church members that the limited geography is consistent with the Book of Mormon and the prophet's speeches. I think that's going to be a big hurdle to overcome. But I think as we discuss this, the only way that's going to be worked out is through respect and through genuineness, and I think that's something that Trent has exemplified for me. And so, anyway, thank you.
By the way, I should notice the historical evidence I talked about by Grant Palmer, an insider's view of Mormon origins. He is dealing with the very problem he's talking with, and his conclusions tend to be somewhat negative. So the trouble with Ralph here to investigate to hear. Let me sum up before we go. We've got enough time for questions. We're not due out of here until 12:45, I think. I have one or two more things that I would like to, that didn't quite come out here, but I would like to at least indicate, although I think all of these gentlemen here are aware of them. As a church member, let me describe these three ways of dealing with it. As church members, then, we can respond to the evidence against Book of Mormon historicity in any of the following ways. We can reject the evidence, but in consequence, the church risks being marginalized and bypassed as unimportant because it ignores the best scientific evidence available. Thus, the missionary part of the church paradigm will be severely damaged. The second thing we can do is we can accept the evidence and accept the Book of Mormon as a religious document without historical content. In consequence, the church runs the risk of losing its claim to restore priesthood power with the loss of Book of Mormon historicity, and thus is its claim as the only true church.
The paradigm change is that we will operate as a non-exclusive one.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. No, I'm not going to go through the other stuff in the meantime.
The thing we can do is we can carefully investigate evidence and accept the portion of it that is clearly correct. Ignore the questionable evidence until it is firmed up and becomes clear and makes and make corrections in our paradigm and doctrine only if and when necessary. The paradigm change is that we accept all truth from any source, and we are not locked into any paradigm or doctrine that can be shown to be false, including our own history. Our claim to truth is our doctrine and practice, not our past revelations. If this requires dropping the claim of being the one and only true church, so be it. In consequence, we save the good things of the church for ourselves and our children and constantly refine the church's paradigm and doctrine for the better. We are free to work on the problems that limit our progress, such as, for example, what do we do about non-human ancestors? We don't know how to fit them into any church paradigm. Remember that we believe in modern revelation to refine our church. So this change is within the most fundamental beliefs and used to be within our normal practice. Many paradigms and doctrines have changed in our past. Now, I intend to choose number C, the third one. I'm going to live by that one. Now, as an individual, I can respond to the evidence against the Book of Mormon historically in any of the following ways. First, I can ignore the evidence and ignore my feeling for truth in favor of loyalty to the church. This would require an adjustment to my paradigm. I can accept the evidence, drop the Book of Mormon historicity and the idea of the LDS Church being the only true church, keep Book of Mormon's inspirational values, stay a member, and maintain and uphold the things that I value in the church. Or third, I can accept the evidence, use the evidence as proof that the church is wrong, and leave the church and lose all I value in the church. Personally, I'm going to use the second one. I don't think it makes sense to just drop it. Not only that, but now I should point out that Trent has indicated some very interesting items. We do not have to totally walk away from historicity of the Book of Mormon as of yet. There are still things that have to be sorted out. Maybe in the future we will be forced to do that. I doubt if even that would force me to walk away from the church. There are things I value in the church, and I don't want to walk away from them, just as these gentlemen have stated themselves. There are things that they value. So anyhow, that's the end, and that's the end of our presentation. We have a whole bunch of questions here. Yes.
Now let's okay. Come on up, or at least pass this back. It's limited in this length, so we'll try.
My question, in some ways, is for perhaps not fair because it's for Jeff Needle. What you were saying about some of him, but I think some of the panelists can also respond to it, and that's that. The answer that it perhaps just doesn't matter right now, or that the actual historicity can be sort of put on hold in terms of, or as Trent was saying, sort of we it needs to be operating on faith. You know, of course we couldn't finally legitimize all of these claims because we have to have, there has to be a portion of it that's faith. I'm assuming Jeff is not a Native American Indian.
No.
And for me that's a kind of a sticking point, is that it might be easier for me as a white Mormon American to say, well, it just doesn't matter who these people were, because I'm not sitting in Sunday school with the teacher saying, here's Dances with Nephi, you know, the token representative of this lost culture or something. And it, you know, I think it does matter in a sense that it has real social implications for the way that we view Native American Indians today, and it certainly did so in the 19th century. So the question I would have is, Can we sort of respectfully look at the Native American Indian population today and say, well, it no longer matters what we say about your Israelite identity?
Anybody like to approach that? That's a sticky one. You're brave.
Yeah. My neighbor that actually approached me, he has two adopted sons that are Polynesian. And so that's sort of why he was like, you know, Tom, let me understand this a little bit. And I think that's going to be a big problem, because this suddenly adopts the element of racism, okay? And Mormons haven't been very good about racism in the past. We have a really horrible track record.
Yeah, except for all the others, right?
Yeah, except for all the others. And if you look around, I mean, we're still. I mean, I'm British, you know. I essentially, and so it doesn't affect me personally as it would if I was in South America and was being told that, hey, you're a descendant of Nephi. You would have to go through a cognitive dissonance if you're hearing this information. At that panel at BYU, there was a young man who stood up and said, I've been told my whole life that I was that the Book of Mormon was for me, and that's third generation, and I'm all that. And he's sitting there saying, holy heck, I'm just learning this right here on the spot. And he asked the panel, a member of the panel said, can we write the church and have them... take the thing out of the introduction of the Book of Mormon. It says the American Indians are the principal descendants of the Lamanites. And one of the guys up there said, well, you can do that. I'm not going to do that. I'm a white guy. So that's going to have to be addressed. And there's already cognitive dissonance reductionism because there's people going around saying that when the curse came upon the Lamanites, that their DNA was changed to Asian, and so you got a whole other round. You're dealing with a whole other round of racism. I heard Dan Peterson essentially say that, the curse was when they married with the Asians, and so you're having a whole other round. I mean, you're already upsetting one group, and now you're inviting a whole other group that's not even involved to be offended. So, yeah, this is and but once. My hope is baby steps. We're just coming into this.
I agree with what Tom has said in this regard. One other issue that I would like to point out that we haven't discussed at all yet is the Native American perspective. They didn't always been here. So when you look at something like the Quick Man, which has been a huge point of contention. And one of the reasons it's a point of contention is that that presents evidence that there's some other origins or some other peoples here that weren't exactly Native American or closely related to the Native Americans.
Explain that a bit more.
What's going on there is that you look at the Native American, or a lot of the tribes at least, perspective on all these debates. Well, where did the Native Americans come from? Did they come from Asia? Or they come from somewhere else. And the Native American perspective is, look, we didn't come from anywhere. We were created here in the Americas. That's their traditions, their beliefs. And so when you look at what's happened with something like the Kennewick Man is the facial profiling, the presumed ethnicity of this individual suggests what's the term that's used? Caucasoid? Versus Mongoloid, yeah, and so that the term Caucasoid is a sort of a loaded term when it comes to people like the Native Americans. That to them means white, and that's not what the term at all means, but that they equate it with the word white, and therefore what they want to do is take the remains, bury them away so nobody can study and challenge their perspectives. So we have all of that to deal with as well. And I agree with Tom that we're taking baby steps right now. There's a whole bunch of ways to try to understand these data and to make them fit into a paradigm that is comfortable for various people. And I think that what's happening right now, the reason this panel is organized, is that what you heard is various ways to handle these data and their implications in various people's lives. Each person working with them from a different perspective.
Did they actually extract DNA from the Kennewick Man?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't know that the Kennewick. I think, as far as I'm concerned, it's still tied up in a legal battle, and they haven't done anything because it's still in a vault, as far as I know. I don't think it's been released to anybody.
That was the last I heard too. Yeah. In the vault. Other questions?
Okay.
Yes. He was there before. I'll get back to him.
Hello, this is my first conference. I'd like to thank all of you for your candor. But overall, as much as it pains me as a Michigander to have to take issue with someone from who studied at the University of Michigan, you referred twice to a crisis. You called this a crisis,
yes.
A looming crisis in the church. And just from my perspective, I mean, I serve on an area high council, and I also serve on the public affairs council, and I get around in this area. And I have yet to go to a family home evening where they're discussing the Pleistocene peopling of the Americas or any of these issues. I agree 100% with what Tom said. Perhaps we should. Well, you referred to a crisis, and I just wanted to know why you called it a crisis. I mean, someone with a Ph.D. in nuclear physics might be very aware of these issues, but your average Mormon in an average war does not view this as a crisis. So I wanted to know, first of all, why you referred to it as a crisis, and also many of you referred to a paradigm shift. And I don't see anything, certainly, in the official church publications that indicates that things are going that way. So I just wanted to know what evidence would you can cite as evidence of a paradigm shift. Cite these isolated incidents.
Okay. The most obvious paradigm, the answer to the paradigm shift, is the fact that even the mainstream of the church is gradually shrinking the area of possible involvement with Lehi, with Nephites and Lamanites and all that sort of stuff. They're saying, well, at the very least, we're going to have to admit that, and they do it in publications. They've actually done this. I don't remember. Yeah, Farms. They're referring some people contacted the church. What is it? It's a department where they always refer to these kind of questions, and they referred them to Farms. And Farms' position is that it's only a small area that was involved in this sort of thing, and that would certainly fit with what you're saying. That's, at the very least, that's where we have to back down to. So that part of it is real. Now, to say that that's a paradigm shift, yeah, it sure as heck is. It also is a paradigm shift from Joseph Smith, who clearly believed that it was the total North and South America. That's not an issue. Okay, so the paradigm shift is real. Are you saying that it isn't, that the most of the church is not aware of this paradigm shift? Absolutely. That's no question. But the world is aware of it. Don't get yourself into believing that they are not aware of it. Excuse me, I'm going to need some water. Okay.
Small portion of our church.
All right. Small portion meaning everybody that ran these articles. I mean, that it was run worldwide. That's real.
A tastier slice of society, but still, it's a small portion.
True.
Largely of intelligence.
Point well taken. Now, the crisis, you're saying a crisis. I define my word crisis in order to overcome this particular problem. The church, little by little, will be forced to make a decision about how they are going to operate in the future. It hasn't happened yet. I even stated that. The church, if you asked a general authority, they might even know what I was talking about. But little by little, they will be forced to face this. They have no choice. And it's going to happen over a long span of time. And little by little, as they are forced to face it, the people of the church will become aware of it because the church authorities are talking about it. So that's what I mean by a crisis. It's happening right now.
I have a lot of respect for scientists and science, even though I'm not a scientist myself. But one of the things that my study of science has taught me is that it requires a certain modicum of humility to be a scientist or really to be a human being. The history of science is a history of each generation, new generation of scientists overturning the axioms of the previous generation. You know, Pope's little couplet, nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light. The fact of the matter is, when we talk about DNA, there's a lot we understand about it, and there's a tendency, I think, to be oversimplistic about it. Also, when we talk about evidence, it is to me a very interesting thing. Although I'm not a scientist, I have read everything that's been published so far on DNA because it interests me. But I am a textual critic, and I am a believer in the reality, and if you want to say the historicity of the Book of Mormon, in the sense that I believe that Lee, Nephi, and Alma were real people, and that this book is really a history of their people, even though written as other scriptural books are, with a degree of mythology included in it. But when people talk about evidence, one of the things that, for me, I'm willing to look at all of this evidence, scientific, but I want the scientists to explain to me how some of the things in the Book of Mormon got there when we talk about that it is a product of 19th century America. There are things in the Book of Mormon that was not in anyone's information environment in the 19th century. You can't find some of those things anyplace, and certainly not among an unlettered boy living on the western edge of the frontier. He might have been uneducated. He was not really illiterate by the time the Book of Mormon was produced. But there are things in the Book of Mormon that cannot be explained as coming from the mind or the imagination of Joseph Smith or anyone else living in the 19th century. And that's my informed judgment of a person who has spent his life studying texts. On the other hand, I do have a respect for the fact that there may be things I don't understand. My guess is that as we go on, we will understand a lot more about DNA and find that it's much more complicated than now seems to most of us, and that it's probably a good idea to keep that modicum of humility in regard to either humanistic or scientific evidence. I've been reading the past couple of months, I ventured into the strange territory of quantum physics, and quantum physics turned the world upside down. And people in Dr. Cornett's profession 150 years ago believed absolutely in phrenology, that you could tell by measuring a person's skull everything about their medical history. No respected doctor has believed that for well over 100 years. My guess is that there are many things we now think and believe that presented to us by science that will also be challenged and overturned as we understand more, just as there are things about textual criticism that I hope will also help enlighten us.
I'll preface my remarks by saying I'm a fan of Bob Rees, so I'm biased. Okay. That said, I appreciate your remarks, Bob, and they, by and large, make sense. Certainly, a scientist who becomes arrogant is dangerous, just as is anyone who is taking responsibility for it and supplying knowledge, information, insight to someone else. So that is important. And clearly, some of the principles of science are sophistication, our knowledge, our understanding, our sense of nuance all continue to evolve. Hopefully, that's what makes the field so interesting. I guess, as someone who is at least moderately schooled in the sciences, I don't lean solely upon science, and I'm actually happy to acknowledge the Book of Mormon as an inspired document. I guess where it comes out is, based on what I know now, and as I think I mentioned in my paper, the preponderance of evidence suggests that it is difficult to produce a construct consistent with the historicity of the Book of Mormon. I am aware of maybe only 5 to 10% of the things which you're aware, Bob, that suggests that even a highly imaginative 14 to 21-year-old could not have produced this volume, given some of the coincidence between, you know, maybe some turns of phrase that you're going to find in sort of the Semitic languages and documents from that period in Semitic languages, but not in any of the writings of that day, nor in the more common biblical texts. So I'm happy that there are some significant, maybe even evidence, that this book is not merely a fabrication, but that there's an inspirational component. So maybe I'd love to, even to be wrong, I suppose that it was completely historically accurate, except for the fact that it's a bloody and depressing book and doesn't give one much hope for the rest of humanity. Given that you had some great societies there that kept, you know, suiciding. And it does remind me more of, say, Thomas Pynchon or Dan DeLillo than you know, Paul or Jesus Christ. It's darn depressing. So, yeah, no skin off my nose if it's not that historical. But I do think it's an inspired work. At some point, I'm afraid that one of my children, they're all smarter than I am, I'm afraid, are going to come up and say, "Dad, is this true?" And when I start saying, "What do you mean by true?" or "What," it depends what you mean by "is," right? I'll have to say it's an inspired work, and like the Bible, it's not necessarily completely historically accurate. And they'll say, "What about the article of faith that the Book of Mormon is the Word of God and the Bible only is translated correctly?" I'll say, "Well, you have to work through these things." And, you know, I'm still here. I'm not completely miserable. You know, I'm actually fairly happy as these things go. Enough out of me.
You know, I have to take a little bit of issue with Bob's statements. I don't think that DNA is chronology.
I don't either. I didn't mean to suggest that. As I say, I read all of that, and I have no reason to discount it. It seems to me very important that any Latter-day Saint has to pay attention to it.
Right. My question for my esteemed panelists is, where is DNA? You know, we're 28, 29 years really into the heart of it. Is that correct? You know, if we just said, you know, 20 years ago, we're speculating this sort of thing, I'd say, yeah, it's sort of like phrenology. But I think we're sort of at the point where DNA has stuff that we can figure out. We talk about what DNA can tell us, but DNA can tell us a bit.
My point was that complicated, sophisticated nature of what he was talking about, that it isn't as simple as people think, well, we go in here and we can check this and this shows that. There's a lot we don't understand about it, we ought to be open for everything that it will try to tell us.
There's a lot that we don't know about it, but there's stuff we do know about it.
Absolutely.
But Trent could...
I think the importance here is, as I was trying to emphasize, not the technology and not what the technology is allowing us to learn and what it's telling us, but to understand, given the sophisticated technology, what are the limitations of its interpretation? Because literally what we're capable of doing right now is going down, if you take a pedigree chart, any pedigree chart, it doesn't matter how long that pedigree chart goes, we're only able to go down the two outside limbs of the pedigree chart. And it's because of the fact that we have so much crossover and scrambling of the genetic material that's not the Y chromosome or not in the mitochondrial DNA, we don't crossing over in those two areas, and so that's why it's reliable for us to be able to trace populations with it. But we will probably never have a technique that allows us to deal with the other 44 chromosomes. That allows us to really analyze what's going on with the rest of the possible population. And I think that's probably what we're more talking about that than the limitations of the technology themselves. As Tom said, it's very sophisticated now. It's incredible what we've learned just in the past 10 years as the Human Genome Project has come to completion. We have just so much insight now compared to what we had. But, on the other hand, we're not going to have anywhere near as much insight as we will 10 years from now. And that's your point as well.
I agree with you to a certain extent, but I want to show the limitations. My definitions of paradigm and crisis come from a book by Thomas Kuhn called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. The whole concept of how a scientist deals with the world has to do with humility. Scientists go through revolutions, no question about it. And we do it through crises, and some scientists are embarrassed, and some become famous on that same business. It is a humbling experience. It's happened to me where I was just dead wrong. Okay, what I'm saying is the scientists will accept a change in paradigm. The issue I'm trying to bring to the surface is, will the church accept a change in paradigm? Will they be humble enough to say, well, maybe Joseph Smith was wrong on such and such an issue, but it doesn't destroy the good things he said?
Before we keep in mind, the church began the change in paradigm.
Absolutely. And that's the other thing I was trying to point out. He believed, Joseph Smith and Brigham Young preached and believed that a change in paradigm was good, nothing wrong with it. And not only that, but new revelation can come at any time. So maybe a new revelation comes in any form, maybe through science, that says, okay, the old paradigm was wrong and some of the old doctrine was wrong. Joseph Smith was wrong on certain issues. We move on. And then the church survives and thrives. And there is much in the church to love and admire. And I don't want to see it go down the tube. Okay, new questions.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I wonder why no one ever mentions the example of Greenland. In Greenland, according to the Icelandic sagas, you know, a group of Vikings went from Iceland to Greenland and they did things, even on to a bit of North America. And and then it died out. And we have some other material from Iceland that suggests that, you know, they kept going they were there for 500 years, and from 900 something to 14 something. But, you know, they didn't leave much of a lasting imprint on Greenland. They did not intermarry with the Eskimo population. They did not leave a Norse, genetic component in the Eskimo population, or did not leave Norse words in the Eskimo vocabulary. And what we did find, though, was some stone churches. They built churches out of stone, and you could find the remains of a dozen stone churches to prove they were there. And then archaeologists started digging. You know, they could find little bits of metal implements and other things that were Vikings. But they sure had, there's a lot of literary evidence of the Vikings being there. And some of it, particularly the part about getting into North America itself, into this Vinland, wherever that is, was long questioned, and until they fairly recently found some convincing archaeological evidence at the very north tip of Newfoundland. That seems to be an example where the literary evidence was, in the final analysis, vindicated by archaeology, but it didn't happen quickly. And so you could have had, I guess this maybe is an argument for support of a localized validity to the geography of the Book of Mormon, that you could indeed have had people come over from the Mediterranean area and settle in in Central American area and have developed a civilization there, and yet not have left that much of an imprint upon genetically or in linguistics upon the Native Americans.
One last question for you.
Yeah.
Sure.
My question to you, Terry, is do those Icelandic sagas mention the, if you will, indigenous peoples of North America? Do they mention the people we call Indians at all? You mentioned them, right?
There is a mention. Obviously, when they get to Vinland, they're defeated by the indigenous population. They have these fights with them and lose out.
So that's in contrast to the Book of Mormon, where there's no mention of such peoples. That's the things that just sort of jars me at the back.
Yes.
Question. Some of the views, opinions expressed today have almost an apologist flavor to them, the same kind of way that you have some people who deny the divinity of Jesus Christ saying, well, it's okay, though, because his moral teachings and parables are really, you know, good to read. It's good, you know, for people to read from a literary point of view. But I'm hearing some kind of the same thing, like, well, you know, even if the Book of Mormon is not the historicity and the literal a literal document from ancient America, it's okay because, you know, it's got good stories. Can I have any of the panelists address this? Doesn't this cause you any kind of a crisis in your faith?